From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. So now another former leader of a former leftist government in Latin America is sentenced and blocked out, basically, of the political process, this time in Ecuador with Rafael Correa. It's getting to be almost like a circus at this point. If you were a part of the so-called pink tide in the past decade and a half or whatever. In other words, if you were a left or even a center moderate politician in Latin America, South America, Central America, certainly any of these countries, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Paraguay, Uruguay, or Venezuela, there is accusations that come from the right wing of, then they're absurd, of corruption. They sit on top of the huge popularity of most of those governments while they were in power because of the delivery of services and the turnaround in people's lives and things. And yet, we have had this situation happen now where we're looking at a prison term imposed, of course, in absentia, imposed now on President Rafael Correa, still the most popular politician in Ecuador, sentenced to 8 years in prison for alleged bribery. He was convicted in absentia of alleged bribery. And, he joins the ranks of, in Brazil, for example, they drove Dilma Rousseff from office on claims of corruption that didn't even ascend to crimes. And they had Lula in jail and, out of the box for the last election. The main thing for Correa also, this is a salient point, is that he is now barred from running for office, which leaves him in the same status that these various people that they go after find themselves in whenever there's an election. We see the same thing with in Argentina, for example, with Cristina.
Right. Yeah, no, and Correa himself, and I can't remember if you mentioned this, Correa himself has said that what this judgment does is achieve via the abuse of judicial process what they couldn't achieve electorally.
Right.
And he's talking about the right-wing opposition in Ecuador. And of course, Ecuador now has a right-wing government because Lenin Moreno deceitfully posed as the candidate of Rafael Correa's political movement in the last elections as a progressive. And then within, even before the second round, he was marching determinedly to the right. And then in the second round, he managed to squeeze in, and his argument was, oh, well, the reason we won is because I was shifting our policies to the right. And then he proceeded to turn into a classic kind of center-right social democrat tool of the local elites.
Right.
And that's what's happened in Ecuador. And you can see that very much in the collapse of Ecuador's health system in response to the current COVID-19 epidemic.
Right.
And the horror stories that you hear of thousands of bodies not being collected by the authorities. Apparently, the Lenin Moreno's government set up a task force to address that issue, and they say that they've now cleared the backlog of corpses that needed to be collected and buried.
The backlog, no less. I mean, I know it's really discouraging when you're talking about a backlog of corpses in the first place. This is the real stuff,
right? So on the heel of that public health disaster in Ecuador, you have Lenin Moreno's right-wing cronies in the justice system coming out with this judgment against Rafael Correa. Now, an obvious question that people should be asking is, well, if the case was so open and shut, why were the Ecuadorian authorities unable to enforce an extradition order against Rafael Correa in Belgium, where Rafael Correa has been living for ever since the last elections, right, in Ecuador? Interpol can't be bothered because they regard the request for criminal moves against Rafael Correa is completely spurious. So you have a situation where, in terms of, in international legal terms, Rafael Correa, and in Belgian legal terms, Rafael Correa is regarded as somebody of unquestionable integrity, and you have the Ecuadorian authorities coming out with this ridiculous verdict, because it's a question of opinion, in the same way that the conviction against Jorge Glass, Rafael Correa's colleague, and actually Lenin Moreno's vice president at the time, the case against Jorge Glass was also one of interpretation. The judges decided that it was likely that Jorge Glass had committed the offense of which he was accused. There was no evidence. There's no solid evidence that would stand up in a conventional court of law. Just as in this case against Rafael Correa, the judges in this case too declared that it was likely that he probably was guilty of the offense, although they have no evidence to prove it. So, you know, and this is just the classic way in which US-style lawfare works, isn't it? I mean, they throw out an allegation, and as you said earlier in your introduction, and this is something that they've done against Lula da Silva, they tried it against Cristina de Kirchner. In Bolivia, they couldn't get away with it because the judicial system there had been reformed, and judges were actually elected by popular vote in Bolivia.
Yep.
And so that's why they had to stage the military coup, because they couldn't use the judicial system in Bolivia. After the coup, now they're using the judicial system because now the right wing control it. And so while Evo Morales has attempted to stand as a candidate and to lodge his candidacy in the now postponed, God knows for how long, national elections in Bolivia, Evo Morales tried to put in his candidacy as a senator in those elections, and the Electoral Tribunal refused to accept his candidacy. So, what you can see, and also it's worth bearing in mind something that the odious phony who's currently the latest Secretary of State in the United States, Mike Pompeo, it's worth recalling what he said about recently when they mounted this absurd claim putting about of criminal activity by President Nicolas Maduro, putting a bounty of $15 million on his head. And one of the things that Mike Pompeo said was that, this is the United States Secretary of State telling another country what is going to happen and what is not going to happen in their country. He said, Nicolas Maduro will never again govern Venezuela.
Right.
Right, so there you have it from the horse's ass.
Right, yeah, a pronouncement from the horse's posterior.
What U.S. Policy in Latin America is? U.S. policy, foreign policy in Latin America is the Monroe Doctrine. We are the ones that are going to decide the political outcomes in Latin America and the Caribbean. And these people are not going to be allowed to run in elections because we know that they'll win them.
Right.
And he's talking about Lula da Silva, talking about Evo Morales, Rafael Correa now. And as you mentioned, and Cristina Kirchner, Cristina Kirchner de Fernandez, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, was also facing that outcome, but they didn't have time. In Argentina, the right-wing government crashed the economy so fast that they didn't actually have time to work through all the judicial steps that they needed to in order to apply lawfare, the abuse of the judicial system for political ends, to prevent Cristina Fernandez from running for office again. And now she's, as a result of that failure by the right wing to complete their agenda in time in Argentina, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is now the vice president to Alberto Fernandez, who is also a very close colleague of Cristina's deceased husband, the much lamented Nestor Kirchner. So in Argentina, and also in Mexico, and in Mexico, the United States, for some reason, were unable to mount a lawfare case against Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's currently the president. And so now they have Argentina and Mexico working closely together in the region to thwart the more extreme expressions of U.S. foreign policy in the region. So, you know, one of the things that they're doing now with this latest COVID-19 epidemic is that they're trying to manipulate that to be able to undermine the progressive governments that the United States and their regional allies want to target. But I think it's symptomatic of their desperation. And although it looks superficially as though progressive forces in Latin America and the Caribbean are very much on the defensive, and I think their resistance is such, and the resistance that they've been able to demonstrate is such that one can say with quite a lot of confidence that over the next 2 or 3 years, it's very likely that the corrupt, inefficient neoliberal regimes in places like Chile, perhaps Colombia, perhaps Peru, certainly in Ecuador, again, have a very hard time trying to maintain the political initiative that they seem to enjoy at the moment.
You know, I've been going through the list of people that have changed, the countries that have changed hands. And I ran through it before. We had Argentina and Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Honduras, Paraguay, Uruguay, and it's not even touching the Caribbean. You had the election in 2015 in Argentina. You have, first of all, of course, the environment in each of these countries, as we've described. Historically, for one reason or another, the legacy of the history of race, of conquest, of indigenous peoples, of all kinds of things, slavery. The legacy of all of it is you have very divided electorates now, where maybe half of the population or slightly more or less has historically been oppressed and impoverished in one fashion or another, and the other half represent what would be called the middle class, maybe the comprador class, the business class, and the elite, and some other small group that swings one way or another. And so the elections are close. no matter what happens, just by design. You have some really severe class contradictions that manifest in one way or another in the political system. And so when there's some change, like you have, for example, a left-leaning government in Argentina, first with Néstor de Kirchner and then Cristina Fernández de Kirchner, and there was some malaise there. There was a couple of problems with, you know, international economics having to do with commodities prices, a part of what had been fueling an expansion somewhat. There were, you know, objective reasons for that slowing down some. And then you had some political strategy that was played by some on the left of withdrawing their support for this center-left coalition, because they said they were trying to force a more, you know, a stronger, more radical position on them. And instead, you elected the right-wing government of Macri in December of 2015. And as we had discussed, like 3 hours after that happened or whatever, that self-destructed within one term. Yeah. And so then you have, you know, what followed, including with Cristina de Kirchner now as the vice president, right? That's what she is, and Alberto Fernandez as the president there in the last election. Bolivia, Morales, they dragged him out pretty much at gunpoint. You know, when
he won that election.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that he won that election.
He won the election. It was recognized by everyone and every institution that he won the election. And then they drove him at gunpoint, basically, out of, you know, out. And then and then that was to have democratic elections, quote unquote, which now have to be called off. In Brazil, Dilma Rousseff was driven from office. The most corrupt and unpopular politician that Brazil could dig up sat as the occupier of the seat until the last election. Most popular politician, Lula da Silva, the leftist president for two terms prior to that, was imprisoned on trumped up charges that were completely fabricated and pretty much dropped after the election, after he had been disqualified from running for office. And a guy who essentially styles himself as a fascist was elected president there. You had Michelle Bachelet. Now you have Piñera in Chile. That is, you know, a switch also from a, I guess, what, a liberal democratic government to pretty much a hard right-wing government now.
Very much so.
In Chile. He went from Correa to Lenin Moreno and the current situation that we've described in Ecuador. In Honduras, you had Mel Zelaya. He was simply removed in a U.S.-backed coup. And elections were held after the U.S.-backed coup, and the military secured control of the country. And that's been the state of things there pretty much since. Nicaragua, they tried to have a coup there last year or the year before, was it? And they failed. 2018, yeah, right, in April 2018. That failed. You know, the Sandinista revolution is still in power, elected into power the last two and a half, 3 terms. Paraguay, there was a soft coup back in 2012 that took Fernando Lugo out and replaced him with Federico Franco, and you've had pretty much U.S.-backed governments in Paraguay since then. And now you have Luis Lacalle Pou in Uruguay, where you used to have the poorest president in the world. All of these things were not the result of plebiscites, with one exception, I would say perhaps in Chile, but rather of overt military coups in the case of Bolivia, or strongly backed by the military and certainly permitted by the military coups under the color of some color of law.
Yeah, and one country that had been left out of that list, Colombia. And they're in Colombia, and there've been more people killed by the death squads there.
Right.
And I think the current tally so far this year is around 70 social and community leaders.
Right.
And something over 20 former FARC guerrillas that opted for the peace process.
Yeah, I just didn't. So, I never considered Colombia part of the so-called Pink Tide. That's why I didn't list them just then.
Yeah. So And in Venezuela, of course, and its success it can be measured in the intensity of the sanctions that it's suffering.
That's right. Oh, please. Absolutely. Incredible success, like Cuba, standing up to, you know, now a decade and change of really harsh sanctions.
Right. So, and in Colombia, and in effect, that something like a quarter of the country is under the control of narco-terror gangs, whose patron is Álvaro Uribe and the current president, Iván Duque. It's like running in a race, but they start out about 30 meters ahead of all the other competitors.
Right, that's right.
When it comes to any election, because they've already made sure that their narco-terror gangs are going to guarantee around a quarter of the vote for them.
Right.
And another country that's worth mentioning is Peru, of course, where Martin Vizcarra, took office after the previous president was disgraced, and he's managed to face down a challenge from the parliament that was largely led by Keiko Fujimori, and he's managed to face that down. And so in Peru, things look as though they're going to be quite stable in Peru.
Right.
Because
I hope so. You know, when you said the prior president, I'd have to narrow it down some. And then, like, the last three or so went right to jail from office, right?
So, what's happening now is that whereas before the COVID-19 epidemic, you could more or less see the outlines of how things were going to develop. In each country, with this COVID-19 epidemic, and there's so much uncertainty because it's really impossible to know how populations are going to react to the respective performance of the different governments. And I think in Chile and in Brazil, for example, and there's going to be a very strong popular reaction against the authorities there. But the flip side of that is that because of the very nature of the epidemic and the measures that are being recommended from some quarters to address the epidemic, and quarantine and locking down whole cities and whole regions is like a glove on the hand for the right wing
figures
like Sebastián Piñera, right? And yeah. I'm quite surprised, in fact, that Bolsonaro decided to look askance at all that, because it's like a gift. He had an internationally accepted justification for applying extremely repressive measures to big chunks of Brazil if he wanted to, right. And he turned down the opportunity. And maybe that's part of the reason why the army have decided to give him an extremely severe slap on the wrist. And for practical purposes, the army now run Brazil. Because they occupy the great majority of official posts in Bolsonaro's government.
That's right. They do.
Military figures or retired military figures occupy a majority of the official posts in how Bolsonaro's government. So it's not clear at all how things are going to pan out once this COVID-19 epidemic finally dies out, as it will. But maybe we should talk about that.
Yeah, we've got about 5.5 minutes, and did want to talk some about the situation. I saw the article that your partner there has at Telesur's website right now about the situation inside Nicaragua with this virus.
Right. Yeah, and what's happening here is that in the same way, and going back to the start of our program, that the United States and its allies have used or abused, rather, judicial process to achieve their political ends. Now, with this COVID virus, this COVID-19 virus, the United States and its right-wing allies are trying to use that as a lever to force out of government. Certainly that's true here in Nicaragua. The legitimate government of President Daniel Ortega. They're alleging that President Ortega and his government have been negligent and are abusing the human rights of Nicaragua's population by not imposing extremely repressive measures to enforce social distancing, as has happened almost all across the Western world. And you know, my instinctive response to that is, well, who are the dictators now? You know,
right.
And here in Nicaragua, the 70% of the economy is in the informal, not strictly speaking, the informal sector, but in family businesses, micro businesses, small and medium sized businesses, in particular, agriculture, is very much based on small farmers and medium-sized farmers, but also the cooperative sector controls public transport, for example. And the cooperative sector is very important in industries across Nicaragua's economy. Now, if you try to shut down that economy, who's going to pay a universal basic income to all those people?
Right.
Yeah, and it's just forget it. And they tried to do that in El Salvador, and it's turned into a complete disaster. And if you look at the figures, which are approved by the organization, the Pan American Health Organization and the World Health Organization, they're vetted by those international organizations. The figures for confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Nicaragua are six. There have been six confirmed cases.
Gotcha.
One of those people died. Unfortunately, they also suffered from HIV. Two people have recovered and are back with their families and back circulating normally, and three people remain under care who tested positive, and there are eight people who are under observation but have so far tested negative. Now, you compare that with El Salvador, and Salvador, with a similar kind of population to Nicaragua, they've got around just under 70 cases. Honduras has well over 100 cases. No, and Costa Rica has something like 400 cases. And so, who has applied the right policies?
Right.
And you're not just talking about who has applied the right policies over the last month.
That's right.
You're talking about who has applied the right policies over a decade or more of public health policy.
That's exactly the point, because it's not just a matter. Let's, here, give everybody this orange drink and it will, inhibit it, or give them, a blue pair of sunglasses or whatever. Now, the thing that shows you the health of your public health program is that whatever you are doing works, that it's appropriate to the conditions that exist in your country. A, you're familiar with them, and B, you have the wherewithal and the ongoing relationship to integrate that into a response to this thing. The proof is in the pudding. There are six cases there as opposed to 300 in Honduras, as an example of the neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. And I just think about this for a minute. Nicaragua has a population of about 6.5 million. New York City has a population of what? 8.5?
Yeah, something like that. 10.
In Nicaragua, over the last couple of weeks, a team of health workers and volunteer health promoters have worked together and made 2.3 million house-to-house visits. Many of those are repeat visits. Now, can you imagine New York's health system organizing that?
Right. We got to stop here. We're out of time. We'll follow this up with you next week, Tony, and thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.